we want to hear all of this. So share your stories. So just encouraging people to share their stories. Well, you can follow Rooted on social media, on Instagram, on Facebook. We are sharing ways to advocate for farmers and for farm to school all of the time. So I think it's really time to just lean into that network, support each other, and we got this. We'll figure it out. But, you know,
thank you, Erica.
We need to spread the word. So, yeah, thank you.
That's Erica Krug with the Madison nonprofit Rooted. Thanks for being here. And we've also had with us Caitlin Turiainen, president of the School Nutrition Association of Wisconsin. Thank you, Caitlin. And thanks again for coming back, Jennifer Gaddis from UW-Madison. It was great to have you all here today. If you've appreciated the show today, please share it on the Wart Online Archive or wherever you find your podcasts. I want to give a shout out to engineer Andrew Thomas, producer Sarah Gabler, news director Shelley Pittman, and receptionist Amy Lutsky. And thank you, listeners, for joining us today on A Public Affair here at WRT 89.9 FM Madison. Stay tuned for Madison Bookbeat. With information that would never be reported.
Disregard the mainstream media distort. Hello, I'm David Harper with the BBC News. Tens of thousands of people have fled Sudan's largest refugee camp in Darfur after RSF paramilitaries took control following days of violence. Zamzam camp has been providing a temporary home to 500,000 people. Doctors Without Borders say the civilians have moved to the town of Tawila. The RSF launched an aerial and ground assault across the western Darfur region over the weekend. The United Nations told the French news agency that their office had verified nearly 150 killings, but there were likely to be more than 400 dead. Our Africa correspondent Mayeni Jones reports.
Footage from the area shows people in Tawila, including children and families, queuing for food. They're surrounded by the few possessions they were able to carry as they fled. The charity Médecins Sans Frontières says many of them arrived in an advanced state of dehydration, exhaustion and stress. In August, a famine was declared in the Zamzam camp, which has been under siege for a year, along with the major town of El Fasher. El Fasher is the Sudanese army's last stronghold in Darfur. Tuesday will mark 2 years since the start of the war between the Sudanese army and its former ally, the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces.
The president of El Salvador says he won't return to the US, a man mistakenly deported and jailed there as a gang member. Nayib Bukele said he didn't have the power to do so. He was speaking during a meeting with President Trump in the White House.
How can I return him to the United States? Like, I smuggle him into the United States, or what do I do? Of course, I'm not going to do it. The question is preposterous. How can I smuggle a terrorist into the United States? I don't have the power to return him to the United States.
The U.S. leader didn't answer questions whether he would respect a court order for his administration to facilitate the return of Kilmar Abrego Garcia to the United States. The White House has acknowledged Mr. Abrego Garcia was deported because of an administrative error. Hungary's parliament has approved constitutional changes which target LGBT people. The amendment cracks down on public gatherings which are seen as promoting homosexuality or gender reassignment. From Budapest, here's Nick Thorpe.
This was the 15th amendment to the 2011 constitution and one of the most controversial. By 140 votes to 21, the governing Fidesz party majority made it possible for the police to ban the annual Pride March in June because it's judged to portray or promote homosexuality. Protesters tried and failed to prevent MPs entering parliament to take part in the vote, but a heavy police presence made sure they could get into the building.
The US semiconductor maker Nvidia says it's planning to build artificial intelligence servers worth as much as $500 billion in the United States over the next 4 years. It makes the chip giant the latest American tech firm to back the Trump administration's push for local manufacturing. Nvidia currently builds most of its processors in Taiwan. BBC News. A US court is hearing a case that could see Meta, the owner of Facebook, broken up. The Federal Trade Commission argues that by acquiring Instagram and WhatsApp, Meta unlawfully quashed competition. Lily Jamali reports from San Francisco.
Meta, which was then known as Facebook, purchased Instagram and then WhatsApp more than a decade ago. In court on Monday, the regulator said those acquisitions unlawfully quashed competition in the social media space and, quote, protected Meta's dominance. Meta says it has significant competition in social media, including from TikTok and X, formerly Twitter, and the FTC signed off on the acquisitions back when they took place. The FTC's case against Meta was brought during the first Trump administration. If the commission proves its case, Meta could one day be broken up by spinning off Instagram or WhatsApp or both.
The UN says more than 60,000 people have been displaced by last month's earthquake in Myanmar. Using new data from remote sensing equipment, the UN Development Programme said around 125,000 truckloads of debris from collapsed buildings needed to be removed. The Washington Post says that American weapons were used by militants in last month's deadly train hijacking in Pakistan. The newspaper traced the serial numbers of some of the rifles used in the attack on the Jaffa Express in Balochistan to the factory that produced them in America. The guns were among US military equipment provided to Afghan forces. Scientists say new research indicates that giving heart attack patients a combination of two low-cost drugs early in treatment could save thousands of lives. Studying 36,000 victims, the British and Swedish teams found that delivering statins and the cholesterol-lowering drug ezetimibe within 12 weeks of the heart attack produced better outcomes. Patients are at greatest risk of suffering a new heart attack in the first year after the initial event. It's estimated in Britain alone it would prevent the recurrence of 5,000 attacks. BBC News.
Do you have an insatiable curiosity about the world? Do you find yourself provoking conversations with your friends and coworkers? Are you a strong listener? Then you should consider applying to become the next host of A Public Affair, WORT's daily hour-long call-in talk program. We're now accepting applications for this volunteer position. The next host will be the voice of Tuesday's show and join a stellar lineup of folks who engage listeners in conversations on social, cultural, and political issues of importance every day of the week. We're looking for someone who is curious and well-informed, comfortable speaking on air, someone who can think on their feet, and has at least 5 hours a week to prepare and host the show. And of course, we'll need you to be here every Tuesday from 12 to 1 p.m. Apply by May 2nd. To find out more information or apply, go to wortfm.org/talkhost.
Welcome to Madison BookBeat, your listener-sponsored community radio home for Madison authors, topics, book events, and publishers. I am your first Monday of the Month host, Andrew Thomas, and I'm very pleased to welcome my guest today, AJ Romrell, for a conversation on his new memoir, Wolf Act, published on February 18th of this year by the University of Wisconsin Press. AJ Romrell is a storyteller, photographer, and educator. His memoir, Wolf Act, is about his experience growing up queer and neurodivergent in the Mormon religion. It earned first prize in the Utah Original Writing Competition and was a finalist for the Writers League of Texas Manuscript Contest. He is a 2025 Pushcart nominee, and his essays, stories, and poems have been featured in Electric Literature, The Missouri Review, Michigan Quarterly Review, Black Warrior Review, Brevity, New Delta Review, and elsewhere. He has been the recipient of the Vandewater Prize in Poetry, the Kenneth W. Brewer Creative Writing Award, and the Ralph Jennings Smith Creative Writing Endowment, and his work has been shortlisted for Plowshares Emerging Writers Contests, Crafts Hybrid Writing Contest, and the Black Warrior Review and New Ohio Review Contests for Creative Nonfiction. AJ's current projects include a second collection of linked personal essays, this one about video games, apocalypses, and his 2020 HIV diagnosis. He's also working on a poetry chapbook and the first book in a new series of queer fantasy novels. When not writing, AJ enjoys dyeing his hair, hiking, reading, watching movies, playing video games, long walks in storms, and long talks over coffee. AJ Romrell, I have coffee in my hand, and it's my deep pleasure to welcome you to Madison BookBeat.
Thank you for having me. I have coffee in my hand too.
All right. We are set for a good show then. AJ, on your website, you describe Wolf Act as a memoir and essays. And these essays take on a variety of different forms. The work is divided into three different acts, and each act is made up of, I guess we'd call them chapters, that are both interlinked but can also kind of stand on their own as well. And just for our listeners who haven't had the chance to read it yet, the majority of the prose is narrative nonfiction, but there are a number of chapters that include, for instance, lengthy lists. You have definition entries like you would find in a dictionary, as well as passages that mirror a kind of Mormon liturgy and educational upbringing. So AJ, first, could you just talk to us about Wolf Act, how this memoir and essays came to be?
I guess it all started, you know, it's been about 9 years since the first essay that I wrote in it was written. And when I started it, I didn't know it was a book I was writing. I was just writing essays about my childhood in Mormonism, coming out as gay, the experiences of that as I was working through it. And over the years, kind of just built up all these kind of different essays talking about different experiences within that. And it was during my final year of my first graduate program at Utah State University that I realized I had a lot of things that I had written over the past, I think at that time it was 5-6 years. And there was a competition in Utah that asked for creative nonfiction books, 50,000 words or more. And I thought, I think I have enough here to maybe make that work. So I pooled it all together to see if there was a story that made sense. Was I writing something this whole time without knowing? And in doing so, realized that I had 43,000 words. So I was almost there. And it seemed like there was this arc of a story happening. And so I wrote about 10,000 more words trying to bind it all together. And it ended up winning the award of the Utah Original Writing Competition. And it was then that I realized, okay, maybe I have something here. And so I actually went back to the drawing board again, wrote a couple more essays, swapped out some things, made it a bit more of a through line. But what was so interesting about the process was that so much of this was written as I was working through it. Writing for me, especially creative nonfiction, has been so much about figuring out all that I went through and processing and then trying to turn that into some type of art form and being able to tell that story to people who might have gone through something similar, people who have never heard of a story like this, people who don't know as much about Mormonism, or people who went through Mormonism and are trying to figure out their own past with it. I think that's why it kind of has all these different structures and types. But when I put it all together, I realized that I talked a lot about definitions. I talked a lot about theater. And I realized I really liked to play in structure and form and make them speak to each other like that, where I was trying to define myself in different ways. And so writing an essay in definitions made sense.
Was a lot of the early writing that you were doing, you said this was taking over the took place over the course of 9 years or so. Was a lot of that early writing, was that self-guided?
I originally wrote only fiction. I was not interested in writing about myself, probably because I was worried about what I might discover when I started writing about myself and my feelings. And then I went to school for creative writing at Utah State University for my undergrad. And for that, I had to take an intro to creative nonfiction class. And I was very angry about that, and I didn't want to do it, but, you know, I had to. And it was in that class that I took with this professor, Jennifer Siner, and one of the first, it might have even been the first class, she told us to write a list of the top 10 things we'd be most afraid to write about. And then we had to choose one of those things and write about it. And what I found was just kind of this explosion in me that it was like I was ready to talk about it, and I just needed that avenue. At the same time, I started seeing a really incredible therapist who pretty quickly caught on that the most honest place I could find myself at that time was in writing. That it was where I'd lived so much of my life lying and hiding. And even at that time, when I was kind of in the early days of my marriage to my ex-husband, was still very concealed and trying to hide away anything I thought might make somebody uncomfortable or make somebody not love me in any way. And I found in writing, I could really be honest about what was happening and what I was thinking and what I was feeling. And so I ended up switching to focus in creative nonfiction because I found that love for it. And I took many more classes with that same professor working through these different things and processing. And so I did have a lot of guidance throughout, which was really nice.
Do you get the sense that the story that you are telling, do you think it will resonate with a lot of other folks in the Mormon community that you were growing up with and either had maybe direct interactions with or just kind of like indirect interactions? But yeah, do you think that other folks will kind of see parts of themselves in this stories that you're telling?
I mean, I hope so. I do think so. In Utah, writing these essays originally, I was in classes with a lot of Mormons and ex-Mormons. Since Utah is just mostly one or the other, I think at the time it was near 70% Mormon of a population in Utah. And so I did have a lot of that sort of feedback. And it was actually interesting moving to Ohio and where I am now and showing essays to people who were never Mormon and didn't know much about it at all. And then having their feedback was very different from having the people from Utah. But the feedback in Utah and from the people that have read it so far that have had that background in Mormonism have talked about their connections to it and how they went through similar things. And it surprised me, but I think only because we weren't supposed to talk about our struggles that way. You know, we were supposed to kind of keep it down. At least my interpretation of everything was to keep it down. Don't talk about anything too hard. Because if you're struggling, it means that you're not doing it right. So you just kind of pretend that you're not, and everybody's walking around pretending like they're totally fine and things are great. And when you start to create these conversations, you realize, wow, there are a lot of people who are also hurting and unsure and afraid and trying to figure this out alongside me. And I just didn't know until I said something about it.
I think maybe here it's worth pausing on the title and parsing both of those words that you use, wolf act, because like acting does seem to be a large component of what you're talking about. But let's start with the first word, wolves. Wolves are they are a very powerful metaphor throughout the work, and you frequently weave in references to wolves in mythology, fables, fairy tales, even like I think some religious beliefs about wolves. How did the wolf metaphor help you better understand your upbringing and all the challenges and changes that you were going through as a queer person in the Mormon church?
Yeah, you know, it was in that moment of pooling everything together that I realized that I just had a lot of wolves that were just kind of around in my writing. My first crush in high school was on the kid who played the wolf in Into the Woods. He was a senior and I was a sophomore, and I didn't realize it was a crush at the time, but it definitely was. And then my senior year, I played a wolf in the King and I ballet. And I think it was my junior year, I played in this little one act, played one of the three little pigs in a courtroom scene with the big bad wolf. And, you know, so there's that. They were always my favorite animal. And so I think intrinsically, I was just noticing them pop up. And then when I put it all together, I saw that they were a larger part of the story. And I've always loved fairy tales and mythology. Again, it seemed like my favorite ones tended to be ones that included wolves, whether it was Loki and Fenrir or Little Red Riding Hood or Aesop's wolf, you know, these different things. I found something so interesting in them, which was that just depending on the story, they were villainous or powerful and kind of heroic. And it just depended on, it was more often villainous, but there were a lot of times I was seeing them, especially in like more today's media, they're kind of being turned around and wolves are kind of put on as heroes. And that really impacted me in thinking through everything I went through, because so often I felt like a villain, either to myself or to the religion or to my ex-husband, you know, these different scenarios. I really forced myself into that role of being the bad person, and it's my fault, and I'm the one doing wrong. It became a really powerful metaphor when I started trying to play with that and trying to think, what if I wasn't the villain? What if I was painted this way and kind of forced into this narrative? And what if I broke that narrative? What if I was able to shift away? And so I think that's where the metaphor really started to click for me, because so much of it was about stories and the stories we hear, the stories we're told, and the stories we are forced into by others or ourselves, and how we go about reshaping that.
Yeah, I feel like the wolf narrative, especially like in the Christian tradition, or you know, a wolf would be seen as a villain. You know, it's something that the shepherd protects the flock from, or a wolf in sheep clothing. And so, yeah, there's a long history of the wolf as being something to avoid or to be wary of. And you've touched on it, but, you know, the second word of the title, act, to my mind, it was tying in with your love of theater, singing, and performance. A lot of the past reflections that you have from high school are centered around stage productions and getting to sing, getting to perform, getting to move your body in space with other people, and also some rejections that come from that. And at the same time, it also seems to hint at your need to continually put on a version of yourself to please others. And so much of your writing is about overcoming a self-hatred that was rooted in having to perform your life a certain way. So tell us more about how acting and performance influenced your thinking about Wolf Act and the story that you were telling.
Yeah, theater was always a big thing for me. Always something I loved. And, you know, it was in high school that I had a teacher who, you know, and it's in the book, but essentially told me I wasn't good enough to be in the play. It had such an impact on me there. But even so, you know, I still had just this love for theater and musicals, especially. So that was already kind of coming naturally. And then when I started looking at all the kind of costuming and masking and pretending that I was doing, it seemed to fall under that same sort of category in another way. So I started having that dual meaning. And that title actually came to me pretty early on in the process of compiling this. And I always thought maybe I should change it, but it just kept on speaking more and more true to the story itself, especially because that act that we perform, especially like in Mormonism, is something that takes a lot of unlearning in adulthood to move through. And I realized that even after I left Mormonism, I was still acting. I was still pretending. I was still saying that I liked movies I didn't actually like, because I had this fear that if somebody disagreed, it would give them a reason to not love me. And so I just kept pretending and pretending until, you know, my marriage fell apart and I was 28 living in Florida, and I realized I had no idea who I was or what I liked. I didn't know what I liked to wear. Didn't know if I liked to wear scarves or not. It was a whole process after moving back to Utah to be a family after, you know, the marriage. I went to the store with a friend, and she just had to pick out clothes for me because I did not know what sort of thing I wanted to wear every day, because that was always dictated by Mormonism and then kind of dictated by what I thought my ex-husband wanted. I had this moment at near 30 where I've kind of felt like this little teenager putting on outfits, trying to figure out what in the world I kind of wanted to put myself out in the world as. And that fell into, you know, what I liked in a partner, what I liked in a movie, what I liked in everything. And it took a lot of time to break down the different acts that I was putting on. And so it felt intrinsic to what the story was.
You are listening to Madison Bookbeat, and I am your host, Andrew Thomas. Today, I'm talking with AJ Romrell about his new memoir, Wolf Act, published on February 18th by the University of Wisconsin Press. AJ, to kind of continue this theme of acting and putting on a face, when you are writing about your marriage, you're also writing about your time spent working at Disney World. And you mention at one point how Disney World is very much a performance space and an acting space, so much that for workers there, they had areas called like front of stage and backstage. How did Disney World, a place of kind of, on the one hand, like, you know, joy and fantasy and imagination and playfulness, how did that help you as you were transitioning into kind of becoming your own person? But then you were also a worker, kind of seeing the backside, seeing, you know, kind of seeing the how the sausage is made. What was Disney World like as part of your journey to who you are now?
I think it was a big part. It's funny because I went there as part of the Disney College program. I finished off my undergrad degree doing like essentially free credits working there. And really it was just a way of trying to go there because I grew up loving Disney so much. Especially like for Mormons, it's, you know, the safe type of movie is a Disney movie. So I always grew up loving it. And I remember when I first went there, learning the backstage stuff was so wild. Like the thing called forced perspective, where they actually build things like the castle bigger on the bottom. And then it goes smaller as it goes up. And so it makes it look like it's bigger than it actually is. And then they do things like pump in the smell of buttered popcorn on Main Street because it'll make you kind of want to get some. They plant trees very specifically to block other lands so you're not seeing the frontier land while you're in the fantasy land. I still found a love for it. And there was something very strange about being in kind of the most magical place on earth, living out this dream that I'd had forever, and I was so unhappy. I felt so alone. It was moving there, being away from my support system physically, I think that finally made me start to realize just how unhappy I was in the marriage and how alone I felt. And even though we both had this deep love for Disney, and we had a lot of things we were very similar with in our love for things, I realized that when it came down to values and what we wanted out of life, we were just very different. And, you know, having my life kind of fall apart while I was working at this place was just this very strange thing. But also being able to be there through that, because, you know, he ended up leaving after a year when we separated, but I ended up staying another 6 months working there. And that became some of the most fun and exciting times that I had. And being able to walk into this magical place all the time really helped me kind of figure out a lot of this, who I wanted to show up in the world as. And kind of brought joy where I wasn't feeling a lot otherwise.
What you're telling us underscores a few of the definitions in your definitional chapter, because you write about irony and you write about juxtaposition, you know, as two very familiar experiences for yourself. And it very much sounds like that. Well, maybe we can pivot from that to the scene where you and a few others are in the cave, because you go spelunking, you go cave diving. And you have this moment of absolute darkness where the guide turns off, I assume it was like a flashlight or a headlamp, he turns that off, and you were very afraid, but then you actually found it to be a very peaceful moment. So I would love for you to read from that passage, and you can set it up in any other way that you see fit as well.
I have always been afraid of the dark, just kind of intrinsically. And so it was the overhead lamps that had always kind of been on throughout the entire like cave. And yeah, he said that he was going to turn it off and we would experience absolute darkness, which we could only experience in deep space at the bottom of the sea or in the middle of a cave. And it felt terrifying to me to have that happen. And then, yeah, it ended up being a very, very different experience, which is where, yeah, I'll come in here. The darkness in the cave is extraordinary, like nothing I could have ever imagined. Where I thought terror would arise, I instead find comfort deep inside. Warmth where I'd expected cold, joy in the emptiness surrounding me. My eyes can't adjust like I thought they might. Instead, they just feel more relaxed. And I want to laugh because I suddenly realize how focusing on the world around me in the light makes my eyes tired. I don't have to try here. In total darkness, it's like I'm floating in a sea of shadow, my breath moving even and long. Carefully wave one hand in front of your face, other Andrew instructs. Can anyone follow their hand back and forth? I try. My eyes move where my hand goes, but it takes a moment to realize that I don't actually see anything. I can't observe myself here. The youngest one in our party says he can, but other Andrew kindly explains, actually, we believe we can see ourselves, but we really can't. I can't help but wonder if I ever had.
That is AJ Romrell reading from his memoir, Wolf Act. And you were tuned in to Madison Bookbeat, and I am your host, Andrew Thomas. AJ, all throughout Wolf Act, there are just these beautiful moments. That it's clear that you have these experiences where things just kind of, moments of clarity come together. It comes together momentarily and dissolves. But one thing that I sympathize with so much of what you were writing about was specifically growing up in a religiously strict culture. Before the show, you and I were briefly chatting about that. But at one point, you talk about your exit from Mormonism. And that was predicated on a very specific thing that came out from the Mormon Church. But yet it's so clear from your writing, like what a strong imprint the faith had on your life. So how do you reconcile things that you sincerely believed when you were younger with who you are now? How does the faith still impact your life, if it does?
Yeah, I mean, I think I've come to the realization it's never going to not impact me in some way. I think, like any trauma, that's kind of how it is. One of the ways I've tried to work through it is actually right after I went through my separation, I tattooed I Choose Joy on my arm as a way of trying to remind myself to, you know, look at the positive things that have come from what I went through. Because there's a whole lot of hard things. The main, I guess, almost its own juxtaposition here is that while the religion caused so much damage, it also created a really safe childhood for me. You know, I was able to just walk down 20 minutes to the Wendy's when I think it was like 13, 12 or 13 when I started doing that. And I didn't have to be really afraid. Like, Utah's a very safe place in those ways. And even more than that, it really brought my family together because they teach that family's the most important thing. And to this day, my siblings and my parents are the people I'm closest to. You know, they're kind of that family I have and they're the family I choose. And not every queer person gets to say that, you know? And so I feel very fortunate that we have that. And it is a very hard thing to reconcile the fact that both really awful things and really beautiful things have come from the same thing. And we have to learn, I suppose, ways and strategies on how to hold them both. And I think that mostly just takes time, unfortunately. I always want there to be a simpler answer, but just accepting that both exist and they both can exist and they both are going to exist. And the ways that the religion caused issues are going to keep coming up. Like, I just, over the past month, have come to realize that the religion taught me to not feel pride. that pride was a really, really bad thing to have. And so I've lived my life really avoiding having pride for anything, feeling proud of myself for writing this book. You know, I kind of forced that away. I can feel good about having the book, but I can't feel pride about it. I can't feel proud that I did it. And when pride is such a big word for queer people, it's been a really interesting thing to start working through. And I feel like those things are just going to consistently pop up every now and then. Learn new ways that it is still impacting me somehow, but work through it each time.
As you mentioned, a noticeable feature for me through your story was just how supportive your family was, at least as depicted in the work. And, you know, the significance of your older brother, who is also gay, and kind of having him as a complicated role model as the story unfolds. But could you just talk a little bit more about how your family changed in relation to their faith over time, as it became more evident that you were dealing with a lot of issues that clashed with the Mormon faith?
Yeah, my parents were always a bit more liberal than most Mormons tended to be. So that was always helpful growing up. But yeah, we were very dedicated to it. One of my brothers and I both went on Mormon proselyting missions to Europe. And it was a big part of a lot of us. And it was actually on the what Mormons kind of call the policy change, which was November 5th, 2015, when the religion came out with, well, it was kind of leaked that they were going to name everybody in a gay marriage an apostate. So it was like actively against the religion, the worst thing you could really be. You go to a level of the afterlife lower than somebody like Hitler would, because you've known the religion and now denied it. And that also the children of people in gay marriages weren't allowed to be a part of the religion. And it caused this crazy stir, especially in Utah. They had a mass group in Salt Lake City, just thousands of people go and remove their names from the religion over the next few days. But I remember everybody in my family was calling me and talking to me and making sure to see how I was doing. And it was over that time period that just about every single one of my siblings and their families left the religion more officially. I think up until that time, they'd kind of been tapering off. But my dad, who taught gospel doctrine in his congregation, he taught it for, I think, 17, 18 years every Sunday, and went to the bishop and said, I'm done. I can't do this. And that kind of support was overwhelming in a lot of ways. And, you know, I know it had to be hard. And I know it is hard at times. I can see it when I talk to my parents about, you know, the hard things I went through. And I'm sure it's tough knowing that, like, they introduced me to the religion and raised me in it and all this, and that the religion ended up hurting. But that's why I also have to focus on those good things that came from it, because I can be grateful and criticized at the same time. And I think I have to show my family the gratitude that I have for the fact that they all left with me and they all supported me and they wouldn't stand while the religion did this sort of thing. And ever since then, it's been very fun just talking, because, like, you know, whether they left for me or for themselves at this point, you know, they've all stayed gone for themselves. And we'll gather around and, like, have some wine and talk about the weird things that we went through and how crazy it was and that kind of shared trauma that we had together. And it's a new kind of relationship that we get to explore now in our adult lives.
That's really beautiful. And yeah, I feel like there are probably a lot of folks who have been through similar experiences who can't say that, you know, as many people have kind of followed them and stayed with them. So much of what Wolfact gets us thinking about is the body And the body is something that American Christianity, be it Mormonism, be it Protestantism, be it Catholicism, the body is something that gets policed from a very young age. And so throughout the work, you have all these commingling feelings of very natural feelings at the age that you were, you know, arousal, desire, but then you have the juxtaposition with shame, fear, self-loathing, self-hatred, tangled up feelings of love. And then as you get older, you also write at length about body modification, be it piercings or tattoos. Talk to us a little bit more about how the body functioned as a kind of recurring theme throughout Wolf Act.
That's a good question. It was a thing that kind of naturally was recurring when I compiled everything. I had this fascination with looking back on how I perceived my body, because it became very apparent that I hated my body. What was interesting in Mormonism is that we're kind of taught not to think about it. It's not even they don't say don't love your body. And they don't say don't hate your body. It's more of a just don't think about it. Your body is God's work. He made it for you. Be grateful for it and take care of it, but don't think too much about it. Because if you think too much about it, then you're focusing on the physical world, and what's more important is the spirit. And so I went through a lot of my life just not trying not to think about it at all. And so in writing, and that kind of honesty coming out, was the first time I really started to explore what it was like to even live in my body. And I started doing yoga and starting to realize, like, oh, this is how it feels when my body moves, which was a weird thing to have in adult life. Mormonism, growing up in it, teaches you to not only not think about your body, but that any sort of sexual thought that comes across is essentially just as bad as having sex, which is the second worst sin, or third worst sin, only after murder and denying God. Anything sexual was very, like, you had to just bury it. And you're also not allowed to get tattoos. You have to be very in control about what you put in your body. You can't have coffee, you can't have alcohol, and a lot of other things. They really try to control a lot of that. And so when I left and started being able to actually think, what does it feel like to be in this body, doing yoga, working out, deciding to get my ear pierced, you know, I have that essay in there called Piercing, because it was such a strong moment for me to almost rebel against everything I'd been taught was going to send me to hell, so to speak. And I could do it and feel powerful in it. And it didn't have to dictate what was going to happen to me later on. That it could be a way to celebrate my body, and it could be a way to accessorize, and it could just be a fun thing. And, you know, it's definitely been a journey. It still is. It's one of the major things that's lingered with Mormonism, is trying to learn how to love my body when everything in me told me that it was wrong. You know, it was bad, that my body was the thing that was causing me to be gay, that those kind of attractions came from the body, not from the spirit. There's a separation from the two. And I also went a little bit too far and got a little bit too dangerous and not thoughtful enough with the body, which is how I contracted HIV. And, you know, that created a whole new rethinking of how to love my body when it felt like it was poisonous. It's a continual journey. And so it made sense for it to sit as a through line, because it's, you know, you live with your body your whole life. And for whether you're thinking about it or not, it's there. You know, you have to learn to take care of it if you want to keep living. That's something I had to learn later on in life.
A kind of respect for the material body that religion otherwise says, you know, is simply just going to pass away, for the more perfect spiritual body. It might also be worth noticing for our listening audience right now that the cover of Wolf Act is It's a stunningly beautiful cover. It's got, we have a back view of, it's kind of like a wolf cloak is what it looks like hung next to a cloak of Red Riding Hood. So these two different personas that recur throughout the work, but also something that you could easily kind of put on the body as well as take off. And so kind of put on a persona as well as take it off. As we near the end of this interview, AJ, I'd love to hear about how you see your writing practice having developed throughout writing Wolf Act and what you are planning on writing going forward. In your bio, it mentioned that you were working on another collection of interlinked essays on some different themes, but I know a lot of our listeners are writers themselves, so I always like to talk about craft a little bit as well. So what are some noticeable consistent things that you see popping up in your writing, as well as how you've kind of noticed yourself change as a writer over the years?
Yeah, it's a tough question. Writing, you know, it's just, it is a constantly evolving thing. And with ADHD is something I've had to kind of keep learning and relearning how to go about doing it. The main thing that I've learned that I've tried to stick with is to show up every day. And that doesn't necessarily mean write every day. It just means show up for your creativity in some way every day, whether that's researching something, reading something, writing something, editing something, just putting thoughts down on paper. I try to, you know, I have a writing journal. I try to put entries in it every day. I don't. I do well, but, you know, I miss a days every week. And I had to learn to just be okay with that, because beating myself up over not writing every day was only ever going to hinder me. Would only ever block me from writing further on. And so that's something I've tried to implement over the years, and I think has worked really well for me, that idea of showing up for myself, for my creativity, for this thing I love every day. And it feels like I am then doing all I need to do to make creativity the center point of my life. When it comes down to process, I've had to learn to just trust it. I find I write best when I don't know exactly where I'm going. And I hate that feeling, because it's scary. And it's like, is this essay going to turn into anything? I don't even know, but it feels connected. So I'm just going to keep writing. And inevitably it always comes together, because it's all coming from me. And so it's always going to connect in those ways. And lately, the thing I've had to be more aware of is why I'm writing. Coming out with a book is a different process than writing one. And when you're coming out with a book, you have to start thinking about, how is this going to be received? How do I get it out there more? How do I talk about it? It becomes very outward. When writing itself, my best writing has always come from when I'm writing because I love it, because I want it, because when I write because I write. And that's when it comes out best. When I start thinking about too much how what I'm writing right now is going to be received, I just hit block after block after block, because I'm trying to force myself once again into boxes that other people have created. And so I am working really hard now to be very conscious about pushing away from that and writing because it's what I want to do. And so what I'm writing now, it's been very crazy, because I'm finishing up my Master of Fine Arts at The Ohio State University. And so I have to have a thesis, which is essentially my second book that I'm working on now. It, as you know, you said in my bio, is a linked collection, more about my journey getting HIV and working through that. It's even more about the body and learning to live in it and love it and be a part of it. It's also about video games and apocalypses, because I realized you got to write about what you want to write about. And I was like, I love video games. I love the stories they tell. I felt very connected to Ellie in The Last of Us. And it took me years to figure out why, which is that she's this girl living with a virus that's killed everyone else. And here I am living with a virus that has killed so many people. And there's this weird survivor's guilt. And, you know, again, I write when I need to process things. And that's kind of been coming out there. And so the collection centers a lot around that, which is really exciting and fun to do. It is a different process than, you know, Wolf Act, where I wrote a bunch of essays and then brought them all together later on. This one I'm doing a bit more purposefully. I think both work. They just both have different struggles in them. And but yeah, it's a really fun, I would say I'm learning to write about joy a little bit more than I used to. And that's what I'm challenging myself to do these days, is to also write about the happier moments in life. Which I did do in Wolf Act. I'm just trying to do even more in the next one.
And I think we'll need a lot more stories along those lines, given the current apocalypses we are living through right now.
Yes.
Well, AJ, I'd love to hear one of the closing passages from, I think it's your second to last chapter. No, it's actually, it's the last chapter before the Wolf Boy Coda.
Yeah. Ghost Boys of Bricolage. Yeah. Yeah. This comes kind of near the end of the whole journey. The fool has something to say, is the section. I used to spend hours every day swiping on Tinder, scrolling through naked, headless chests on Grindr, replying to the WhatsApp messages on Scruff. I once believed this to be the way of dating. To f*** enough men that I'd eventually find the one I was meant to be with. But this has turned cyclical, and I'm tired of going in circles. What remains is a ghost, some spirit remnant clinging to my body, my memory, my blood. I don't think there's an exorcism for this. Here's the thing. I once tried to make a list of all the boys I've had sex with, as if I could bleed them from my body if I could place their names on paper. And now, as I read through it again, I can't remember most of their faces. I can't hear their voices. What sticks with me is random and fragmented. A stretch of dark hair, the sound of Gilmore Girls in the background, a tongue against the crevices of my skin, his shower beating down on my back, the mountain smell of his deodorant, the tungsten ring I once bought him, the cold edges of a bed, the lock that clicked as I sent him on his way. These things don't leave me. I don't need them to. I'm sitting here on this couch, in this room, in this home I have made my own. My cat purrs beside me. Terrence traces the length of my fingers with his. He places his arm on my shoulders. I snuggle in a little closer. He kisses me on my cheek. Here, ask me what it feels like to come alive. My body is telling the story. Come here and listen. This is more than I could have imagined.
You just heard AJ Romrell read from his new memoir, Wolf Act, from the University of Wisconsin Press. AJ, it has been a pleasure talking with you today. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me. It's been wonderful.
You have been listening to Madison BookBeat, and I have been your host, Andrew Thomas. You can find a full-length recording of this interview on wartfm.org and a podcast version wherever you get your podcasts. Be sure to subscribe to Madison BookBeat to stay up to date on Madison authors, topics, book events, and publishers. Thanks today, today's talk producer, Sarah Gabler, and news director, Shali Pittman. My man, Alex Frizzell, wrote and performed the intro and outro music. Coming up next is 3 hours of jazz with Alex Wilding White. Keep it here on WORT 89.9 FM Madison, listener-sponsored community radio. afternoon, WORT listening family. This is Andrew Thomas, and I hope you enjoyed my interview with A.J. Romrell. I spoke with him back in February when the book was first published, but it is airing today. I decided to end the program a little early today because I wanted to come to you, Madison BookBeat listeners, to see if you had any recommendations for authors or new titles that you would like to hear either myself cover or other Madison BookBeat hosts. We always try and focus on authors that are associated with Madison or Wisconsin in some way. So if you know of some folks who are coming to town or you see books that you are interested in that are coming from the University of Wisconsin Press, I would love for you to get into contact with me. So you can contact me personally at andrew.thomas@wartfm.org. Again, that is andrew.thomas@wartfm.org. And as always, you can contribute to this wonderful radio station. It is community powered. It is listener sponsored. You can go online at wortfm.org, click on the donate button in the upper right hand corner, that nice orange button, and you can make sure that WORT, which is currently celebrating its 50th year, can survive another 50 years. Public programming, public radio, independent media is so important in these times, and we always appreciate what our listeners do for us. So I hope you enjoyed the show today. Please continue listening to Madison BookBeat and keep it here on WORT 89.9 FM Madison. We're going to hear a little bit of music before we move to the Insurgent Radio kiosk, and then it will be 3 hours of jazz with Alex Wilding White. So stay tuned.
The WORT Board of Directors will hold its regularly scheduled meeting on Wednesday, April 16th at 6 p.m. in person at the station, 118 South Bedford Street. The public is welcome to attend. Meeting attendance is also available via Zoom. For information on how to attend this meeting virtually, please email president@wardfm.org.
Make Music Madison is back on June 21st for the 13th annual day of free outdoor live music across the city. Here's how you can get involved. Online registration for musicians to participate and venues to schedule events is open through June 1st at makemusicmadison.org. All genres and styles of music are welcome, and there are no age limits or skill levels required. The Make Music Madison website is used to match artists who need a stage with venues who seek performers. At noon on June 20th, matchmaking ends and all shows must be confirmed in the system. Again, advance registration for venues and musicians at makemusicmadison.org closes at 11:59 p.m. on Sunday, June 1st. And mark your calendars for Make Music Day on Saturday, June 21st. Bringing you a variety of music every day of the year. This is WORT Madison.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and ResTech Services, serving area businesses, nonprofits, and multi-dwelling properties with high-speed, net-neutral internet, digital phone, and television services. On the web at restechservices.net or by phone at 608-663-3868.
This is the Insurgent Radio Kiosk for Monday, April 14th.
I'm Rick Smith.